This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump returned to New Hampshire this week. He delivered a speech at St. Anselm College, renewing and broadening his call for a temporary ban on Muslim immigrants in the wake of the mass shooting in Orlando.
When I'm elected, I will suspend immigration from areas of the world where there is a proven history of terrorism against the United States, Europe, or our allies, until we fully understand how to end these threats.
On the floor of the U.S. Senate, Democrats, including New Hampshire's Jean Shaheen, also responded to Orlando, filibustering for 15 hours in an effort to force action on gun control.
Moments of silence and expressions of sympathy are just not enough. This Senate, this Congress, needs to pass common sense gun safety legislation.
In Concord, lawmakers held a special session and approved $1.5 million for drug interdiction programs, such as Manchester's Granite Hammer. House Democratic Leader Steve Shurtleff spoke just before the final House vote.
Mr. Speaker, I don't look at this as being bipartisan legislation. I would rather look at this as being nonpartisan legislation. This is something that the entire body can agree to.
It's our weekly news roundup on The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Call in. The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome. Today we're joined by a terrifically well-informed panel, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader in Sunday News, Kathleen Ronayne, political and State House reporter for the Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. Let's start with Orlando and its aftermath. Let's start on the Senate floor in Washington. Democratic filibuster, agreement that there are going to be votes on bills, Democratic bills, Republican bills, agreement's been elusive on guns. Is this time going to be any different, Dean?
Hard to know. I think it's likely that there will be at least a vote on some of these Senate amendments. I think it's been scheduled for Monday. So this was precipitated by Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, hearkening back to the Newtown shooting, the Sandy Hook school shootings. And his goal really here was to force a vote on a couple of issues, the closing the gun show loophole and access of guns to people who are on these sort of no-fly or terrorist watch lists. As you mentioned, the Republicans, I think led by John Cornyn from Texas, are going to have a couple of alternatives. The filibuster accomplished its goal, which is something that doesn't often happen. We've had other filibusters in recent years. Ted Cruz did one. Rand Paul did one. There have been a few others. So they're going to get the vote in the Senate. I think the House is a more difficult sell. We're sort of where we were, in a sense, in the same place we were back with the Connecticut shooting several years ago, where people thought, you know, if we can't do gun reform now, it's just never going to happen. So get a little bit of movement coming out of the Senate filibuster, but there's no guarantees that it's really going to make it through the House.
Yeah, in the Senate, this is kind of a repeat of a vote that they took. I think it was late last year after San Bernardino on people on the terror watch list having access to guns. There was a bit of a debate over where Kelly Ayotte actually stood on it at that time, because I think Democrat Dianne Feinstein had offered an amendment. Republican John Cornyn had offered an amendment. And we have not heard Kelly Ayotte speak on this on the U.S. Senate floor. I think that she might be doing that next week is what I had heard, but I don't think anything official is scheduled. But she has been calling for, you know, I think on her Twitter feed, she said we should compromise on this issue, but hasn't necessarily been specific about where she's at. Her concern with the Feinstein Amendment last year, which would have prevented people on the terror watch list from buying guns, she said was that there wasn't enough due process for people to get off the list. Democrats dispute that. So we've kind of already seen this argument play out, and it's unclear if anything is really going to change in the wake of this. But I think that depending on how Kelly Ayotte votes, we'll see Democrats probably try to make that an election issue.
Well, obviously they already are. And, you know, Jean Shaheen was among, I think there were 30 Democrats who joined joined in. You know, Democrats feel like they have some momentum on this. Hillary Clinton has made this a focus of her campaign. You know, and for senators in swing states facing tough re-elections, Kelly Ayotte, Rob Portman in Ohio, some others, you know, there's a belief that that you know, maybe they need to vote on something. And so, Gary, what do you think? Do you think that – what do you think we're going to get out of Ayotte on this? Is it clear at all?
Well, I don't think it's clear right at the moment what she's backing. But, I mean, Jeanne Shaheen was quite clear where she stood. And I thought it was quite interesting this week that that Governor Maggie Hassan, who is running against Kelly Ayotte, came out and said that she would support an assault weapon ban, a sensible ban, I think is what she called it. And it was kind of the first time she'd been that direct about support for that.
I mean, she wasn't terrifically direct in an interview that was on NH1 that I saw where she was, you know, obviously Governor Hassan's been very much, you know, message discipline has become a real trademark of hers. And obviously, this is something Democrats are going to push. How do you think this plays? I mean, obviously, the gun issue, it's been a tough one in New Hampshire.
It is a tough one. I mean, we're a very pro-gun state in so many ways. But the other side of it is, I mean, you look at all the polls, even in New Hampshire, and there's a lot of support for background checks. There's a lot of support for doing away with banning assault weapons. So it's a tough issue in New Hampshire, but it's one that you can't really try to walk both sides of the line on.
Yeah, and I think you will see Hillary Clinton run more directly and harder on this issue than we've seen any recent presidential candidate, just given the sort of the environment, given the polling data that you've talked about, and the feeling among Democrats that this is actually an important issue that they could make progress with.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and Governor Hassan, I didn't see exactly what she had said on NH1, but a little later, I think later in the day after the executive council, she was talking to reporters and we asked her a couple times about how she felt about assault weapons ban, and she said she would support something. She would support a ban that was she probably used the phrase common sense, and said that there's a way to do that while making sure that hunting and recreational guns are still allowed. So, you know, she did say she would support an assault weapons ban. And she also, criticized Senator Ayotte for not supporting that Dianne Feinstein bill last year. And so I think that she stepped up her criticism a little bit there. And we might see that happening a little bit more as things go forward, especially depending on how Senator Ayotte votes next week.
Well, obviously, for Democrats, this is, to use a phrase Governor Hassan likes to use, kind of an all-hands-on-deck moment on behalf of, tightening some gun laws. You know, on the Republican side, it's a little murkier. Obviously, we have the bills that we will see what comes out of the Senate or doesn't come out of the Senate. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, meanwhile, is, pledging that he's not going to stand for tightening gun laws. He's meeting with the NRA. How do you think – I mean, do you think we're going to see a separation between what the top of the ticket, putative presidential nominee Donald Trump says, and people like Kelly Ayotte in tight races are going to say, Gary?
Well, I think – well, I mean, they're already starting to separate themselves. I mean, it was so interesting when you compared Clinton and Trump this week when Trump was here in New Hampshire. And I mean, his answer was to ban people from areas where they're known terrorists, Muslims – so on. He turned to like a whole group of people that he wanted to keep out of the country, while, there were people right after that that were in his own party that were stepping back from that as fast as they could.
Why don't we take a listen to what Donald Trump said at St. Anselm College earlier this week.
We cannot continue to allow thousands upon thousands of people to pour into our country, many of whom have the same thought process as this savage killer. Many of the principles of radical Islam are incompatible with Western values and institutions.
That was Donald Trump speaking at St. Anselm College earlier this week, certainly consistent with the campaign message of, tightening our borders that, arguably, got him to where he is now. Dean, what did you make of Trump's speech?
Sure. Well, as Gary suggested, I think the kind of impact of it has been – it's been fairly divisive. I think there were some people who, got behind him, and in this sort of was an invited audience of about 110 people. And as we've discussed before, I think, Josh, in some of your reporting, some of the sort of Republican key Republican officials and candidates skipped the speech. He made a sort of a slight adjustment in the Muslim ban, now saying it would only be countries where there's a significant evidence of terrorism, which are going to be likely to be predominantly Muslim countries to begin with. But that is a little bit different than what he said before. But as we know, he's kind of been back and forth on this for a while. He was very firm on it. Then he said it was just a suggestion. Now he's very firm again, but with this slight adjustment. This Muslim ban continues to be a very divisive issue within the party, and you can just see with the Republican leadership in the House and Senate, they just kind of wish the whole thing would go away. They seem just very uncomfortable and sort of resigned to having to deal with this on a week-to-week basis.
So, Kathleen, we were both at the Trump speech. How do you think it went over? It was, as Dean said, it was a small crowd and with some notable absences in terms of people being on hand who are seeking office when their party's nominee was speaking. What did you make of all of that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that it was an invite-only event, and I think it was mostly invites by Trump supporters in the state. So it wasn't necessarily surprising to me, like some of the people that weren't there. I mean, it was for gubernatorial candidates. We had Frank Edelblut and Jeanne Forrester were both there. The speech seemed pretty well received. I mean, it was a very pro-Trump audience or people that would be open to his message. Former House Speaker Bill O'Brien was there, who's been pretty vocal that he is not a Trump fan. And he, liked the speech very much. We spoke with him after, and he said that he thought, Trump's approach to national security was exactly right. So really well received. But interestingly, a lot of the Republican gubernatorial candidates asked to comment about it didn't. Jeanne Forrester, I think it was maybe the next day we asked her about it. And she said she thought that he did a good job, but she didn't really say much beyond that. So I think people are still kind of not exactly sure how to respond to him, specifically people seeking office. They're not necessarily saying, yes, I agree with this ban on immigration from specific countries. It was also interesting to me that he suggested that was something that he would do with his executive authority to decide where immigration, where immigrants can and cannot come from. And I asked some Republicans who were there after if they were okay with that, given that the Republicans in general have not been very fond of Obama's use of executive power. And the response I got from some of the people I talked to who are Trump fans, Representative Baldessaro in particular, is that, as long as it's something that's allowed by the Constitution, then it's totally fine if Trump wants to use his executive powers for that. So a lot going on, but I think it's particularly interesting that Trump's response is about terrorism and it's about immigration, whereas on the Democratic side, we're seeing, talk about guns, guns and terrorism versus immigration and terrorism. So kind of talking on parallel planes.
It was interesting. I spoke to the former House Speaker Bill O'Brien before the speech and after the speech. And before, and he was somebody who's a big Ted Cruz supporter. He was like, I'm supportive of Ted Cruz and I remain skeptical of Donald Trump. Afterwards, he was pretty bullish on what Trump had to say. Jeanne Forrester, she got out of the room pretty quickly. But, obviously most Republicans, it's a different dynamic if you're running in a competitive primary. Also, the political calculations, if there are any, are different. But one thing that struck me about the speech was interesting was the way in which Donald Trump tried to, put Hillary Clinton on the spot, claiming that he would be – his policies on immigration, on tightening the border, on national security would actually be more beneficial to gays and lesbians and women than Hillary Clinton. Why don't we take a listen to this?
Hillary Clinton can never claim to be a friend of the gay community as long as she continues to support immigration policies that bring Islamic extremists to our country and who suppress women, gays, and anyone else who doesn't share their views or values.
All right, Dean. So do you think there are many, that Donald Trump is likely to tap into a great deal of support from the gay community and galvanize women based on this?
His kind of the positions he's taken with the LGBT community have been a little bit different than your typical conservative in recent years. So I think some of his comments distinguish himself in that regard. But this is an interesting argument to make that to the extent that these terrorists are targeting gays and lesbians, and that these home countries have rules that are very oppressive to those communities, that he would actually be a better fit. You know, one other thing I heard in that clip that became kind of an interesting bone of contention is this issue of Democrats' inability to use the phrase radical Islamic terrorism. And he brought that up again, and he got Hillary Clinton to respond and use the phrase. And then you may have seen President Obama gave kind of a very kind of tense speech about the whole issue of using that phrase. And saying it was sort of beside the point. And the other interesting thing was to see a sitting president so involved in the campaign so early. I mean, he really is going to be out there campaigning as a surrogate for Clinton. It was interesting to see him jump into the fray so quickly. You know, part of that is because he's been one of Trump's most frequent targets. And he's also a little bit, Obama also remembers the whole, you know, birther issue, which Trump was a central component in that.
Well, one thing that, I mean, to be clear, what Hillary Clinton said was radical Islamism. And, yeah. You know, we could consult scholars to find out what the distinction
between
Islamism and radical Islamic terrorism. But, obviously Trump felt good about hearing those words out of a Democrat's mouth.
Yeah, I mean, she presented it as something that wasn't really in the end. I think, you know, she presented it as something that's just not an issue for her. And then Obama presented it as something that for him just doesn't really change the strategy, that it's a semantic distinction. But you're right. She did say Islamism, and some people suggested that that was kind of a very fine-grained, nuancey way to get around it. But we'll see if it continues to be an issue.
All right. We're going to turn to the State House in a minute and the action there. But you know, before we go there, let's talk a little bit about, you know, there were a lot of House members at the Trump speech. You know, Kathleen says there's an invited crowd. I mean, do you think that people should read much into the fact that, you know, Kelly Ayotte was not there, that half the gubernatorial nominees were not there, that no Republican running for Congress is there? Or is that something that, you know, Democrats are making more of than it's worth?
I mean, I think it's hard to tell. I mean, I don't know from the Trump campaign exactly what the invite list looked like. I don't know if they reached out to Kelly Ayotte and invited her, if they reached out to Frank Inta and invited him. I mean, I think that certainly if they did and those people turned it down, that's something that we should read into. And I also think, you know, just in general, I mean, it is surprising to see, you know, a presidential nominee come to town and not have some of the biggest, the biggest names in New Hampshire politics on the Republican side there. I think that, you would tend to expect that. I would imagine, you know, if Hillary Clinton comes to town, we'll see a lot of, you know, prominent Democrats campaigning with her. But I just don't know enough to say if they were invited. And I mean, I guess if they weren't invited, then that also says something too.
I mean, have you seen any precedent for this sort of thing, Gary?
Well, I think it's kind of rare when a nominee comes into town and nobody really, a lot of the top people running for office don't really want to be associated with them. That is kind of rare.
All right. Coming up, more of this week's headlines. Stay with us for more of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, you can join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests this week are Gary Reyna of the New Hampshire Union Leader in Sunday News, Kathleen Ronan from the Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. All right, let's turn to the State House. Special session yesterday. I was indisposed. Kathleen and Gary were there. Granite Hammer, the money's going through. Was it as ill-humored as it seemed from afar?
It was a fitting end to this session, actually. It was a very fitting end. It was long, tedious, contentious. We had the intramurals between the Republicans. The whole debate over suspending the rules took 2 hours. And everybody who spoke for and against it were all Republicans.
And so to be clear, in order to introduce a bill late, there had to be a rule suspension, which requires, you know, two-thirds vote. There was some suspense, or at least a lot of sort of saber-rattling before this that well, they're not going to have the votes. You know, there was a little bit of a margin there. It was sort of more win than substance in terms of opponents?
It was a fairly – I mean, a substantial number that wanted it. I mean, I think a lot of people thought it was going to be a lot closer than it was because a lot of people were working very hard to make sure that it didn't happen. But it did happen by probably 20 or 30 votes, which is significant for a two-thirds majority.
Okay. So what precisely is in this bill, Kathleen?
Oh, so the bill includes $1.5 million, and it's going to go to, I believe, grants to police departments to expand police patrols. So most of it is meant for overtime costs so that the police departments can put more officers on the streets in, like, highly drug-trafficked areas attempting to, you know, stop the flow of drugs into the state. I also think it provides a little bit – some of that money will go to the state forensics lab for overtime costs. They have a major backlog in terms of the drugs that they're evaluating a lot of times. You know, you can't tell the difference between heroin and fentanyl if you are just looking at it. So that goes to the state forensics lab. And they have to analyze that, and they are—they do not have the staff and resources to really handle everything that's coming their way. So I'm not sure how much of the money, but a little bit goes to them. And this is a program that's already operating in Manchester called Operation Granite Hammer. And what police say and what officials say is that they've already taken tens of thousands of doses of illegal drugs off the streets through this program. There's some different numbers being thrown out. One person said 25,000 doses. Somebody else said 50,000 doses. So not exactly sure what the proper number is there. But they're saying that this is something that works, and this is something that should be expanded statewide and something that we should be spending money on. There were opponents who just, one, didn't want to introduce the bill at all because they said it kind of flouted House rules and wasn't the right procedure that the chamber should be using. But some of the other opponents said, do we really want to spend this money on enforcement or do we want to spend this money on treatment? You know, is sending more money to police programs really the right way to go? Representative John Burt, who spoke quite a few times, a Republican from Goffstown, said, people addicted to drugs need is help. They don't need a hammer was kind of his line that he kept using. And Republican House Speaker Sean Jasper was countering that by saying, we need to keep the drugs out of the hands of these people in the first place. And I think he even said something along the lines at one point is, people don't need help if they're already dead and we need to keep these drugs from getting to them. So it was a pretty contentious day overall. They were probably arguing for about 3 to 4 hours on the House floor over a variety of issues related to this bill. But it did eventually pass and the governor signed it yesterday afternoon.
And we've talked for a number of months on the roundup about the shift in philosophy about how to deal with the drug crisis. And you think back to many years ago with the war on drugs and three strikes and you're out and all those kinds of law enforcement attempts to crack down. The ethos now has been more to figure out how to treat this as an addiction rather than as a crime. Yet I think there's still an attempt to make a distinction between, people who are victims or who are users versus kind of the drug dealers and the organizations that are bringing the illegal drugs into the state. So it's been interesting to watch this debate evolve over the years. And it sounds like this is the same kind of debate that we heard in a microcosm.
Well, Gary, what did you make of whether or not the briefing on the bill that was largely conducted by members of law enforcement? Did that have any effect? I was watching some of that, and it struck me that I couldn't recall a time when you had that many law enforcement people, briefing the House on what a bill would mean.
No, I thought that was quite. We haven't seen something like that before. I mean, it's very similar to what happened before the Rules Committee last week, where many of the same people were there talking to the Rules Committee, trying to convince them that they really need this money. And I'm not sure that it had a lot of effect. I think the votes probably were pretty well set before the briefing was ever held. But
the final vote did seem to be more or less mirror, what, for lack of a better term, we could call the sort of Jasper coalition of
Democrats,
Republicans who supported him for speaker, minority of the Republicans plus the entire Democratic caucus essentially. Is that telling of anything philosophically, or is this just sort of ill-humored end of the session people? How much of it is intra-building politics, and how much of it is philosophy on the drug question?
Well, I think they're related, Jed. And to be honest with you, I think the people who were opposing Jasper are people who are not in favor of things like this. I mean, he's a libertarian, a free state sort of wing of the Republican Party. And so the philosophical differences flow over into the bill. And it sort of, I mean, it was sort of like we had these two bookends at the beginning of the session 2 years ago or 18 months ago and now this. And it looked like things were sort of getting taken, you know, things were getting a little better. People were getting along a little better. Then we get this, and it's obvious that there's still this great divide.
But by and, I mean, but by and large, it does seem that a lot of the drug-related bills, you know, have been passing in a bipartisan manner at the end of the day. You have anything on that, Kathleen?
Yeah, I mean, they have been. And yesterday, after Governor Hassan signed the bill, or when she signed the bill, they had this big kind of press conference up in the chambers that was Governor Hassan and Sean Jasper spoke, Jeb Bradley, Steve Shurtleff, Donna Soucy. So they had this whole bipartisan coalition, and there was a lot of, you know, not, they weren't just talking about that bill, but kind of a lot of the work that they've done on the drug bills over the session and saying, you know, this, the way they've handled this is proof that government can work, et cetera. But it struck me as interesting. It seemed that there was it was very self-congratulatory, you know, this thing that was happening
shocking
after they signed this bill. But, you know, we can't forget that this is an idea that was introduced probably about 8 months ago when they first held that they created this task force with a special session when everyone said tackling drugs is our number one priority. We're going to do it quick. We're going to do it fast. We got to the last day of the session. Somehow nobody on either side knew that this bill was going to fail. I mean, it was attached. Part of the reason the Democrats didn't get on board is because there was a retiree health funding change attached that they eventually took out. But it was kind of this big shocker. And then you've got everybody kind of freaks out. And the police say, we really need this. And Democrats and Republicans say, we really need this. So, you know, they have to come back into session. They have to wrangle the vote. So it didn't. It didn't really seem like something that everybody had under control and that everybody had put priority on, because nobody knew. Like, it waited till the last day and no one knew it was going to fail. And then you have everybody coming together saying, look at us. We did this great thing. We passed this bill. And I asked Jeb Bradley and Sean Jasper after, you know, was what happened here? Was there a failure of leadership here that led us to not get this done during the normal session? And, you know, what Senator Bradley said is that, you know, ultimately it is a sign of leadership that when this did fail, the House, the Senate, the governor were able to come together. They were able to find a way to get it through. And, you know, so I guess I just thought it was a little interesting that there's a big to-do over this bill that, you know, they if they all wanted, they probably should have found a way to pass without to call themselves back 2 weeks after the session ended.
Well, I mean, if anyone's been, you know, paying attention, as we all have, to the early goings of the gubernatorial race, you know, we know that one person's definition of leadership on the drug crisis is another person's definition of failure. And, you know, I mean, how much do you expect the drug issue, which, you know, is a new one in state politics, really, even though they've been dealing with it in Concord, to be something that moves voters now that the legislature's done?
Well, I think there's a UNH survey out that basically says this is the number one problem. People think this is the number one problem facing the state. So as long as this is the number one problem facing the state, it's going to be a key issue, particularly in the gubernatorial race. It's going to be key issues in state Senate and probably in the House races. It's an issue that, you know, it's always been way down on the list of important things. Usually it's jobs and
economy. Well, I was talking to Andy Smith, the UNH Survey Center, about this, and you know, I said, is there any prior issue that you saw spike so dramatically in terms of the public concern? And he said, prior to the recession, you know, people were feeling reasonably good, and then all of a sudden, you know, things went off the rails, and everybody was understandably concerned. And he said that this has been a more dramatic spike than that. And he also said one of his findings was that half the people in the state that he surveyed know somebody who's had direct issues with heroin. And so, you know, how that all plays out politically is going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an important part of the race. I think that politicians are aware of voter sentiment, and it's kind of reflected in the political environment. We're seeing, you know, in the U.S. Senate race, you know, Governor Hassan was hit with that ad by the Karl Rove One Nation Super PAC ad that criticized her on the fighting the drug issue here in the state and in the governor's race. We've had Republican Jeanne Forster, propose life in prison without parole for people who sell drugs that cause an overdose death. And Ted Gatzis is talking about declaring a public health emergency. So I guess absolutely is reflected in the public discourse. And I think it will be something that people are focused on, obviously, among other issues. But this is a little bit unusual.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what Senator Forster said earlier this week? She was speaking to the Concord Rotary Club.
Drug dealers need to understand that in New Hampshire, under a Forster administration, there's going to be zero tolerance for drug dealers. That means if a drug dealer sells drugs to somebody and it leads to death, they're going to be tried for murder, and if convicted, face life in prison without parole.
Okay, so that was Jeanne Forster earlier this week as she rolled out her drug policy while talking to Rotarians in Concord. Kathleen and I both had the pleasure of being there afterwards. Senator Forster clarified her position a little bit, gave it a little bit more nuance. What'd she say, Kathleen?
Yeah, I think, it's not quite as simple as just saying that if someone sells someone drugs that lead to an overdose, you're going to try them for murder and put them in prison for life. It does have to be more nuanced than that. And, we did ask her to clarify after, and she said that there would be a little bit of, that there would be discretion between someone who is more of a, someone selling
like
drugs on a low level.
Drug dealer versus
someone selling drugs
on a low level,
right, versus, a big time drug dealer. But, I mean, it's tough. If you are going to say that the sentence is going to be mandatory life in prison without parole, the discretion usually happens in the sentencing part of it. So how are you going to have that discretion between those two classes of people if you're saying that it's mandatory life in prison? I think that needs a little bit more fleshing out. And also, it's pretty difficult to charge drug dealers with murder. I think we're seeing that right now. Joe Foster, the attorney general, has a policy in place where they're treating overdoses like crime scenes right now. They're trying to bring harsher charges against people. The charge they're usually doing right now is something called death resulting, and it's under the Controlled Drug Act, which can carry if they can trace a specific dealer to a specific death. And, his position is that, especially if someone's selling fentanyl, this is poison. They know what they're selling is deadly. And that can carry a sentence of, I believe, life in prison with the possibility of parole. So we're seeing the death resulting charge brought more, but the AG's office has yet to charge any person with murder for drug deals. And this is, a policy that they've been looking into a little bit more. So it's not as simple as just saying anyone who deals drugs that leads to an overdose death is going to be tried with murder and put away for life. It's much more complicated than that. So it'd be interesting to see exactly what kind of changes in statute she would advocate for if elected.
Well, I mean, not only Jeanne Forster, but also Manchester Mayor Ted Gatzis this week unveiled his plan to fight drugs. And as we know, Manchester is sort of ground zero for this whole issue. And he also is talking about charging people with attempted murder.
Fentanyl dealers.
If you deal fentanyl and somebody overdoses on it, he's suggesting you get life without parole, the same basic position that Forster has taken. So, I mean, it's hardlining this whole thing. And, I mean, let's be honest, this isn't really something that's going to be that easy to accomplish. I mean, you got to get this through the legislature. And I'm sure everybody's going to tell you that as you get through there and you start getting close to it, this is going to cost the state a lot of money. When you start putting these people in prison for life. We had the, the truth in sentencing law, and everybody thought it was great. Everybody had to serve at least a minimum sentence. And then all of a sudden the jail's filled up and everybody's going, whoa, this is really expensive. How can we get the population down?
How much do you think policy aside, this debate is taking place within a Republican primary, competitive Republican primary, where support of law enforcement is often crucial. Jeanne Forster announced support from some members of law enforcement. It seems pretty clear that Manchester Mayor Ted Gatzis at least has, Police Chief Nick Willard definitely has his back on Twitter at a minimum. You know, he went after Chris Sununu after he suggested during his campaign filing last week that there hadn't been leadership at the state or local level. I mean, how much, you know, the policies you say, Gary, will be complicated, but how much do you think this is about short-term political positioning?
Well, I mean, we obviously have an election coming up, so.
Yeah, it's interesting that certainly within the Republican primary, we may have a discourse that is, you know, I'm tougher than you are. Who's tougher than the other person on crime and drugs? And then in the kind of the general election, having a soft on drugs, tough on drugs kind of discourse, which is a pretty traditional discourse on drug issues rather than the kind of recovery, treatment and addiction model that has been discussed a lot recently. Mm.
Yeah, and we're seeing every candidate say that this is an issue that we don't want to politicize, but obviously it's becoming very political. And I think the trick with an issue like this is when you come out and say – when you criticize, when you say there's been no leadership or, you know, the state's not going in the right direction, people are going to look at you and say, well, what have you done? And that's what we're seeing with Chris Sununu. He came out very strongly and said there's been no leadership on this issue at the local level, at the state level, yet – and, you know, Chris Sununu himself has said we do need more money for this. But now his opponents are starting to look at him and saying no leadership. Well, you know, where's the evidence of what you have done? And I don't think that he's, you know, he says that he asked the drug czar to resign, but he's, you know, yet to really put forth a policy or to say, hey, look at my record of X, Y, Z things that I have done. So it's a tricky issue. It's because it is so sensitive and people feel the impact in their daily lives.
I mean, my recollection is he'd also opposed the creation of that position, you know, kind of way back when. But, you know, why don't we listen to what he said at his filing that got him into the hot water?
Over 1,000 people died from this crisis. That's 1,000 families torn apart. That is tens of thousands more that have drained their bank accounts and their 401ks trying to get help for loved ones. This is an absolute crisis across the state, and we've had no leadership in Concord. We have had no leadership at the local level.
All right. That was Chris Sununu when he filed for office. Got a lot of pushback on those comments on Twitter almost immediately from Police Chief Nick Willard of Manchester. That continued. Mayor Gatsis suggested that Chris Sununu needed to apologize. Jeanne Forrester said it was indicative of his lack of maturity. You know, and the Democrats have been talking about drugs somewhat. Steve Marchand, he launched his gubernatorial campaign at a recovery center. You know, Colin Van Ostern, when he filed, said, you know, talked about how he called for a special session as a council member. How do you think this is going to play on the Democratic side? Any differently?
I mean, I think on the Democratic side that they'll continue to talk about it. They'll probably be talking more about treatment and recovery services than the law enforcement side of it.
All right, more in a minute on The Exchange Weekly News Roundup. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, you can call us. Do call us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email address is exchange@nhpr. We're joined by Gary Rainover, the union leader, Kathleen Ronayne of the Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. So the filing period for state office has come and gone. You know, the expected candidates mostly filed. Some unexpected candidates filed. You know, what do you take? Are there any big takeaways now that at least the primary fields are set for you, Dean?
Well, it's interesting. A couple things. You know, I think one thing is the kind of the size of the governor's race. We got, I think, at least seven people running in the two major parties combined, and also at least one independent libertarian candidate. That's what you expect to see when there's an open seat like that. So it's interesting to see that there are a lot of people kind of stepping up to run for that office. And then in the congressional races, I think we expected a kind of a bigger field to challenge Frank Ginta. We now have just Rich Ashew is going to challenge him in the Republican primary. Carol Shea Porter no longer has a direct challenger because Sean O'Connor has filed as an independent. So it's interesting. I think that sort of one-on-one in the Republican primary for Frank Ginta is probably almost more difficult for him than if it had been a multi-candidate field. And then, you know, with Annie Custer, who we have not talked a lot about, there's an interesting Republican primary shaping up as well there with Jim Lawrence and who ran in 14, and Jack Flanagan, the former majority leader. So some good races shaping up, a lot to talk about. It's always interesting to see how that will all play out, given that there's so much energy directed at the presidential race and at the U.S. Senate race.
One thing, I mean, it was interesting if, you know, Frank Ginta filed by proxy.
Right.
You know, he's tried to keep his head down, you know, in the wake of the FEC settlement and, you know, further revelations. I've been reporting Gary's paper about, you know, how that actually went down. I guess I would tend to agree that the fewer candidates in the race against him, the worse it is, the potential to sort of galvanize a sort of anti-Ginta vote. But what do you think, Gary? Do you think that you know, this is going to be a rough go for him with, you know, a guy he faced before, Rich Ashley, running against him, who's at least well-liked by established Republicans?
Right. And I think it's going to be very tough for Frank Ginta because, I mean, when you had the four people in there, you had Dan Innes and Pam Tucker. I mean, the four of them in there, that could be a pretty easy. I mean, it would be very easy for Ginta to get the number of votes he needed.
I mean, there were several clear strains that those sorts of people might attract that would, you know, dilute the vote of his of people who don't like him.
And now it's just the two of them. And as you said, Rich Ashew is a very popular guy. He's been around the political scene for a long time. He worked for BAE and then the University of New Hampshire Law School recently, and the Rudman Center, I should say, at the University Law School. So I mean, he's going to have a lot of. I mean, you got to look at the money, obviously, and if it's any indication what's been going on in the past, Ginter's had some trouble raising money since all those problems came down. And I don't think you're going to find that Mr. Ashew has any problems raising money.
Yeah. And so, Kathleen, any takeaways from you out of the filing period? I mean, you know, we were both there for a lot of the filing, as essentially a place where, you know, they sign the paperwork, they head to the back room of the Secretary of State's office, they have a media availability, they often lay out, you know, sort of what they perceive to be the lead themes of their campaign. Did you hear anything there that you found particularly striking in light of our, on either side of the ticket, in light of our, you know, the political atmosphere around?
I mean, I think what's interesting to me is that, and I don't know if it's presidential primary fatigue or what, but this is, in 2014, things were much farther along in all of the races at this point, or at least it seemed that way. In all of the, I mean, we're starting to see in the Republican gubernatorial primary these candidates differentiating themselves and going at each other. But in the Democratic gubernatorial primary, these candidates are really still trying to define themselves, trying to put out what their message is. You know, at this time last year, I feel like in the second congressional district, that primary between Marylinda Garcia and Gary Lambert was already really going strong. And here, like, we've barely heard anything with Jack Flanagan, Jim Lawrence. There's just not a ton of news there. So I think, you know, with the gubernatorial candidates on the Democratic side, it really is, you know, these people don't have a lot of name recognition. And I didn't hear a whole lot from any of them as to really set themselves apart. I mean, we had Steve Marchand saying, you know, I'm the most progressive candidate. But we had Connolly and Colin do a lot of basic bio, a lot of just trying to kind of sell themselves to the voters. On the Republican side, obviously, all these candidates keep getting asked about Donald Trump. And nobody it's been interesting on the Republican gubernatorial side. No one has really embraced Trump. No one has run away from him either. But none of these candidates have really said, you know, Donald Trump's my guy. I agree with him 100% of the way. I want to be out there campaigning with him. I think they've all been asked if they would campaign with him, and they've all given these kind of wishy-washy answers. So I think that reflects the political environment in New Hampshire. But, you know, this guy won the primary pretty big, and none of these candidates are really willing to stick by him 100%, but they're also scared to run away. So I think we'll continue to see that dynamic kind of play out.
Well, it does seem, I mean, if you look at the margin, Trump, I mean, he won the primary in every category of Republican, basically. So, you know, a lot of people have said to me, well, you know, I'm surprised people who don't like Trump have said, you know, I'm surprised some of these candidates aren't more explicitly trying to separate themselves from him. And, you know, that's an easy thing to say. But if you're a politician and you're looking at somebody who did so well in the primary, and you can argue that the primary and the general are very different animals, but it's interesting to watch.
It's interesting. You know, Kathleen, the point you made about the Democratic field in the governor's race, there really is no clash between the candidates. They're each off sort of doing their own thing. And it may be a function of the fact that on the Republican side, certainly Gatsis and Nunu Forrester, currently elected officials in office, probably cross paths more frequently. On the Democratic side, Van Ostern is the only person who's currently in elective office, even though Steve Marchand was the mayor of Portsmouth for a while. So they're all sort of kind of off in different parts of the state doing their own thing. So I think that's a really interesting distinction. And I wonder at what point will the Democratic candidates start to go at it with each other? Because you're right. It, in a way, it affects their ability to get name recognition if people are not reporting on any kind of interesting clash or attempts at distinguishing themselves.
What I thought was one of the more interesting things with the whole filing period was the biggest crowd among the governor's candidates when they came in to file was actually Frank Edelblut's crowd. I mean, he had the place packed, and more so than any of the other gubernatorial candidates, and everybody sort of looks at him as also ran. But when you have the kind of money he has, and he just hired the guy who was Brett Littlefield.
Paula Page's consultant.
So, I mean, he's somebody who's, you can't just dismiss him. He's going to be an important part, and he certainly has the right-wing credential covered. I mean, nobody's going to get to the right of him.
He was at the Trump event, and I will say again, this was an event of invited Trump supporters and people, generally on the right side of the Republican Party. And I witnessed a lot of people go up and saying, you know, Frank, you did a good job here, you did a good job there. People very enthusiastic about him, and you know, in a four-way primary. You know.
With none of them really, even with the Sununu name, none of them have great name recognition in that race.
Gatsis is up. I think Gatsis and Sununu seem to have decent name recognition. Edelblut, maybe, you know, if he has a breakout debate performance or something in August or early September, that might help him.
Well, and he was all over the place during the presidential primary. You could not go to a candidate event and not see him in the front handing out his business card to people. So I think he said during his filing he's handed out like 10,000 business cards or something like that. I definitely have gotten like at least three or four. So, but I think that, you know, he's working hard and he has a lot of, state reps behind him. And I hear some people sometimes refer to it as a three-way primary. And I even think that you hear some of the other candidates refer to it as a three-way primary. And I think I do think that's probably a mistake.
I mean, as far as the Democrats go, I mean, having sat through most of the filings, it is interesting the way in which it seems that the issues that Democrats and the policies that Democrats believe the state needs, you know, are sort of a piece. I mean, we hear a lot about rail, which seems to be, you know, becoming a new sort of definitional issue for the Democratic Party. We hear a lot about clean energy, solar, and those things are foregrounded much more than anything else. And on the Republican side, you know, we hear a lot about, I mean, Chris Sununu talked about this was in the context of the drug issue, but he was saying, you know, this isn't the New Hampshire that I grew up in. And, you know, from the Republicans, we hear a lot more of a sort of kind of restoration. And maybe that's simply because, like, they haven't held the corner office in so long. But what do you make of the different ways in which the parties and the candidates for governor are talking about the current landscape, Gary?
Well, I think, you know, it's primaries. And, I mean, we've seen, if you want to say, the Democrats the progressive Democrats have been underground for a long time in this state and nationally. And with Bernie Sanders, that brought out the progressives. And you're seeing a lot more of that, particularly all three of these candidates in the Democratic primary would call themselves progressives.
But do you think the fact that they would call themselves that, but it is interesting in this atmosphere that you don't have anybody, taking the pledge off the table in the way that we did when Jackie Cilley ran against Governor Hassan. And while Hassan ended up winning that primary pretty easily, there was some angst in the Hassan camp back then about, you know, not entirely sure how this was going to turn out until close to the end. And, it does seem to be interesting that in a moment when liberals are allegedly sort of flourishing and you have Bernie supporters, that you don't have, you know, unabashed liberals running for, at least on fiscal matters, at least stated, you know, running for office.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, Bernie Sanders won really big here, but we're seeing, you know, we're not seeing any of these candidates run really far to the left. I mean, they're saying they're progressive, you know, they're talking about some progressive ideas, but, you know, they're not going the way of democratic socialists. And I think they've even all been really hesitant to say anything that they would do differently from Maggie Hassan. And I think that what we've seen in New Hampshire over the last couple of decades is very centrist Democrats in the corner office, people who are pretty careful. They don't do a ton to rock the boat. You know, they kind of keep things rolling along. And I think that we're seeing these Democratic candidates say that they kind of want to continue in that model that Governor Hassan has followed. And will that excite and ignite, you know, all these Bernie Sanders supporters, maybe new voters who came out during the primary? I don't know. And I think this Saturday is the Democratic convention where they'll all have a chance to talk kind of one after the other. And I'm really interested to see how they do in that setting, following one another, and how they try and differentiate
And Elizabeth, themselves. I mean, Elizabeth Warren's going to be there, and you know, as well. And so it will be interesting. I mean, what do you think we're going to hear out of this?
It's interesting. I think my sense is from having had some conversations with some of these candidates, and also just watching them over a period of time, they're all kind of they clearly want to win, and they've sort of strategically navigated a path that's kind of down the middle between the traditional model, which, you know, Jeanne Shaheen, John Lynch, Maggie Hassan, the sort of more centrist model on the one side, and then the newly energized progressive wing of the Democratic Party. So I think you're going to try to see them not necessarily have it both ways, but to try to figure out where that centrist path is. And, you know, I remember back when John Lynch ran for re-election in 2010, and I think he was literally the only Democrat to get re-elected that year because of the Tea Party revolt. I remember a lot of progressives complaining about him, but they still voted for him in the end. And I think that's what these candidates are probably hoping as well.
Well, one thing that's going to be taken up at the convention this weekend is, you know, resolution regarding superdelegates, which has been a point of friction between, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters and, you know, sort of more established Democrats. You know, any thoughts on where you think this is going to go?
I mean, it's hard to say. I think most of the people that support superdelegates, you know, superdelegates are put in place for a reason. They're supposed to be different than the normal delegates. So I think that, you know, if you start to have all these state parties vote to make the superdelegates vote the same way as the delegates vote, then why have the superdelegates at all? Which I imagine is right. You know, so we'll have to see. I think what I read from WMUR is that Donna Susie and then someone on the Sanders side supporting this resolution. I don't know where it'll go. I would think that, you know, some of the people who hold these positions in New Hampshire, you know, would advocate for keeping them. They're there for a reason. But how much support, you know, whether or not that support that Bernie had from primary voters translates to, you know, people that show up at the Democratic convention, I don't know. And I think it'll certainly be an interesting debate. And I'm also really interested to see, you know, this is supposed to be about the state party, the state candidates. But what kind of message of unity Elizabeth Warren calls for? Because she's kind of one of the few figures who really has the ability to speak to the Bernie supporters and say, you know, get on board with Clinton. So how that all plays out should be pretty interesting.
Well, you know, I mean, if you look at these superdelegates, you get, you know, in who they are in this state, and you have to say, if you're a Democrat at that convention, how angry are you going to get about Jeanne Shaheen or Kathy Sullivan, who brought the party back for years and years? I mean, I think it's a little hard to vision this big explosion of opposition to the superdelegate.
On the one hand, on the other hand, kind of as a more national policy, I think given what Sanders has accomplished this cycle and his push for changes in the party, it's hard to speak in favor of the superdelegates without sounding slightly anti-democratic, because you essentially are arguing for a system that really allows party elites to kind of put their thumb on the scale or control the outcome a little bit. So there's going to be a lot of pressure to get rid of them.
All right. So you're headed to the convention tomorrow, Kathleen?
Yes, I will be there. So it should be a fun time listening to what our elected officials have to say and people who want to hold those seats. Again, you know, the differences between the speeches that Mark Connelly, Steve Marchand, Colin Van Ostern will give should be pretty interesting. I think it's one of the first times since people have really been paying attention to this race that they will all be up there right in a row. I think back in the fall, you know, some of them spoke at events, but now that now they're actual candidates, were in this race, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Okay, beyond that, what are you guys thinking about covering next week, Gary?
Next week, it should be nice and quiet at the State House. There are a couple of things coming up at the end of the week at the Fiscal Committee, but that's about it.
Today at noon, it's the next Pints and Politics at the Barley House with Republican gubernatorial candidate Jeanne Forster. Next week, I'll be filling in for Laura again. Tuesday, we're going to do a show on the congressional races. Wednesday, a new book on liberty and the common good. And Thursday, an update on Iraq and Afghanistan. So it'll be a busy week.
All right. I want to thank all of you for joining me. Dean, of course, Kathleen, and Gary. I also want to congratulate Gary on his long career covering the State House. Very long career at the end of the month, off into the sunset.
Yes, I am. I'm going to be retiring.
All praise be to Gary. Thanks for joining us on this weekly New Hampshire News Roundup.